sales win rates have plummeted to a mere 17%, and outdated technology and tedious manual processes are to blame. Meanwhile, managers lack the visibility they need to hold their teams accountable. But imagine a world in which these crippling issues are solved automatically. Revenue.io automates the most frustrating parts of sales so reps can focus on what they do best, selling. Completely automate pre-call research, logging conversation data in your CRM, writing post-conversation recap emails, and prioritized outreach. And as reps book more meetings and close more deals, managers gain the real-time insight they need to scale what's working across their entire team. Ready to say goodbye to tedious sales processes and watch your win rate soar? Head over to revenue.io to learn more.
I know we keep saying the same thing, but if you don't have sales leaders and sales enablement in the boat, what I find is about 20% of the sellers out there, you show them this kind of stuff, it's like, got it, you never see them again. 20% is just not in their DNA. I don't care what you do, it's not gonna happen. So it's really that 60% in the middle that you really have got to have that nourishment to help them, but they can do it. We've seen it too many times.
Hi, friends. Welcome to the Sales Enablement Podcast. I'm your host, Andy Paul. That was Stephen Timm. He's the founder and president at Finlistic Solutions and co-author of a new book with our other guest today, Melody Astley, who is the chief revenue officer at Finlistic Solutions. And they're joining me today to talk about their new book, which is titled Insight-Led Selling, Adopt an Executive Mindset, Build Credibility, Communicate with Impact. In our conversation today, we're talking about insight-led selling, what it means, and what it means also to sell with impact. We get right to the root of the problem. As Stephen and Melody speak to the topics right at the beginning of their book when they write, quote, "The salesperson should be more interested in learning about my business instead of telling me about theirs." So we talk about research from their book that finds that only 19% of sales managers believe their sellers are trusted advisors. So you think about that. If so few managers think their sellers are trusted advisors, what percentage of buyers, think the same thing? Well, we'll get into that. And we dive into three things that buyers want from sellers today that they uncovered through their research and writing the book. One is to learn something from you that they don't already know, to demonstrate that you can help them achieve their desired business outcomes, and to make their life easier. So we get into all of this and much, much more. But before we get to Stephen and Melody, I want to remind you to subscribe to this podcast wherever you listen to it. And if you subscribe, we'd certainly appreciate it if you could leave us a review, give us your feedback about how we're doing. So thank you. All right, let's jump into it. Stephen and Melody, welcome to the show.
Hi, Andy.
Both joining us from the Atlanta area today.
That's right, Hotlanta.
Is it today?
No.
Yeah, I was going to say.
That's more figuratively speaking.
Yeah, it's a great town. I was telling Melody before, Stephen, you joined us, I, back in the 90s, spent a lot of time in Atlanta. I had some favorite places to go, but we were up in the northern suburbs most of the time with the business I was doing. So not a lot of downtown like in Buckhead or those areas. So anyway. Welcome. So we're going to talk today. Well, before we get started on that, is why don't you tell us a little bit about yourselves and the work that you do? Then we'll talk about your new book.
Great. Okay. Melody, you want to go first, please?
Sure. Well, I have been with Finlistics for about 9 years now, and I'm responsible for sales and marketing across the company.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Very good. And Stephen?
Yep. And I'm the founder of Finlistics. I founded it about 20 years ago. And what we did originally is consult for companies out of the Fortune 500s on improving processes, making more money. My background's, I'm a finance type. Mm-hmm. And I had this epiphany in the 2000s that, well, if these are the ways that companies run themselves, why wouldn't enterprise sellers be thinking the exact same way as the executive? So What I do now is I focus on our strategy and thought leadership, those type of things. So having a great time.
So you work with companies, with their sales teams, your services. So describe your services that you offer.
Melody, you're our VP of sales and marketing. Go for it.
We work with sales leaders, right? Because we believe that any kind of sales transformation starts at the top and needs that sponsorship. So sales leaders, sellers are our users, sales enablement leaders, to roll out programs to help their sales and marketing organizations better understand their customer. And we talk about that from an outside-in orientation. So often sellers just come in and think, okay, here's what's on the truck. These are the features, speeds and feeds, functions. This is my technical jargon around this conversation. And what we see consistently is it does not resonate with these executive buyers. They get deferred or they get shoved out the door, right? So actually it can create brand problems for these companies.
Oh, absolutely.
So how do you tool up and how do you provide the change in mindset and behavior for these organizations to transform and understand from the client's perspective how they buy, how are they measured, how do they set goals and strategies, how do they budget, how do they prioritize, and how does that vary across different buyers, right? Mm-hmm. We see now, and it's part of the consumption economy, right? Everything is cloud-based, subscription-based, so the time to value is so much faster. And switching costs are so much lower.
Lower, right.
So what you see because of that is there are more stakeholders in every deal than ever before, right? The end business users involved. IT's often involved. CFO's often involved. And each one of those roles is measured and cares about different things. So how do you figure out quickly how to attach value in a way that resonates with them?
Mm-hmm.
That's what we do.
And to add to that, these buying groups are much further down the buying journey before they even want to talk to a salesperson. So you got to be more relevant now than ever. And Andy, real quick, we're always doing surveys and polls.
Right,
and what we did one about, you know, how well does your sales force know your customers? And only about 20% said, hey, we consider ourselves trusted advisors. 40-something percent said, well, even if we know their goals, we don't know how to align our solutions. And about another 40%, you know, the numbers aren't going to add up exactly, but another 40%.
Well, yeah, I've got the numbers from your book.
Yes. Yeah, it's like they promote, still promoting features and functions. They're like, what the heck? So anyway.
Well, yeah, I wanted to get into that. We can do that now because I was going to talk about it later. But yeah, you have the survey you cite in the book that only 19% of sales managers believe their sellers are trusted advisors.
Right.
And nearly a third of the managers, 31%, think their sellers still focus on features and functions. And a full 50% of the managers said their people know the customer's goal but struggle to align their solutions to those goals. So
Right. Here's
the question. That's on the sales manager. What the hell are they doing? I mean, we talk about you know, change starts from the top down, and which is, you know, absolutely true. But we have this issue in sales is that, quite honestly, sales leadership is the weak link in the chain.
Yeah, it's tough because, you know, especially first-line sales managers, right? It's brutal in that they're being asked to do so many things. A lot of times they've been promoted from within because they were a really good rep. Well, a really good rep does not necessarily make a really good sales leader, right? So when they look at how they're spending their weeks, are they really allocating coaching time and time to transform and really go through deals? Or is it more like a forecast session and spreadsheeting and spending time in CRM? So especially on the first line sales leader, it still needs to come from even higher than that because you need somebody to be able to clear the plate, make a statement that this is important and show the benefits of that transformation. So it comes right back to top down.
Well, yeah, but I think it's more fundamental than that. And which is that, yes, you're absolutely right. Frontline managers are ill-equipped for the most part to do the jobs we're asking them to do. So it's a very tough job. But I think that lack of enablement isn't just frontline managers. I mean, it's all up the chain, right? I mean, it's What does your typical VP of sales know about, you know, the science of performance improvement?
Right.
Well,
nothing.
We're finding that number is around 10%. I mean, yeah. When I do these things, I'm throwing penalty flags at sales enablement and sales leaders all the time. Because the individual seller, I mean, unless you give me the tools and the ongoing encouragement and I get to go to the President's Club every year, why am I going to change? I won't.
Well, right. And but that behavior is being modeled at the very top, right? Is that
I agree.
The reason sellers, I mean, I like to use the analogy. So here is assume that your sales manager, let's say even frontline manager, but it could be at any point in the chain, is let's say that you are the manager of a manufacturing plant. You're manufacturing widgets. And if, you know, take your 19% number, if 4 out of 5 widgets failed to work in the field, wouldn't the manager...
You have a quality control problem.
Wouldn't the manager be fired?
I mean... Yeah. And hopefully before the company filed for bankruptcy.
Yeah. And yet here you have, in your survey you cite in the book, sales managers reporting only 19% believe that their sellers are trusted advisors. I would think that all of them would have said, oh, shit. Right? But it's like, oh, yeah, only a fifth of them are. It's like, well, what are we doing about it? You have all these issues in sales, and you point out several in your book, starting with these three. And it's like, okay, who is the change agent here? Because, yeah, I don't see these numbers changing a lot.
Well, when they do adopt this, there are best practices, right? That requires the change management and long-term behavior change and making sure, like I said, over the long term, that sellers are transforming. I mean, sometimes the organizations will tie it right to their HR plans. You need to demonstrate these competencies or you're not going to get in or get promoted or whatever the next thing is. I mean, you really can be disciplined around that. And what we're seeing and hearing more than ever, it's like we were almost ahead of this curve. Little did anybody know what 2020 would bring. But now we see people throw around value selling all the time, right? Mm. And you can ask 5 people what it means and you'll get 5 different definitions.
Oh, yeah.
Well,
I've got my own. I'm sick.
Yeah, and everyone has their own definition of value.
But I'm right. But yeah, go ahead. Okay.
But you're right. But the
no,
most
I'm
important
right.
Lens through which to look to demonstrate value is through the customer's eyes.
Yes.
And now that we are not looking eye to eye as much anymore, these organizations are having a sense of urgency. How do I capture that meeting? How do I cut through this noise? How do I get the attention? And this aligns just, you know, perfectly with that. Little did we know, right?
Yeah.
Little
did we know. Steven, you're about to say something.
Yeah. And you know, Andy, even the basics, right? Because we do this all the time. And one of the most basic, you know, this whole customer first, insight, you know, led selling, whatever you want to call it. But even basic things like, okay, I understand the goals. How's what we going to do help? Or, hey, I'm a finance type. And, you know, I think everyone should know some base level. Okay, I understand, you know, revenue growth. I understand direct cost. And the question we get asked all the time is, okay, so I sell automation. I sell cloud. How do we help? And that to me is not on the individual seller. That is up to sales enablement, sales leaders to say, look, here's our playbook, right? Mm-hmm. And you know, it's up to you to go apply it. But it's just amazing how many people are talking the talk, but they're not walking the walk because they're not giving their sellers the enablement, the knowledge, the tools to go do this. And buyers know it. That's why they don't want to talk to them.
Well, yeah, I mean, right. So there's a lack of focus on, and you know, Melody, you talked about this, is there's a lack of focus on, yeah, how does the buyer experience how you sell?
Right. Well, that's one of the things we did in the book, Andy, is we interviewed a dozen or so senior level executives. So all kinds of different roles to match the way that customers buy, as well as from companies like anything from like Topgolf to Home Depot to P&G and big companies, people who've had executive buyers who have had P&L responsibility and veto, direct veto authority over literally billions and billions of dollars of spend. Mm-hmm. And what they tell us consistently is they all said things in different ways, just different styles, but they all said, tell me something I don't know, because 90% plus of our meetings with salespeople are just absolutely useless. Yeah. And it makes us angry, and it makes us angry with the seller, and it makes us angry with the companies too, because sure. It's like, why are they putting people out there like this to come and stumble around and waste our time? It's annoying. I'm pissed.
Right. So, well, this is,
and so that's why they wanted to help us with the book. You know, how do I, it helps them too, because if people adopt this and actually glean some nuggets from it, it makes the buyer's experience better. Go figure.
Well, yeah. When you look at what the impact, I just posted about that this week in conjunction with my new book, which is that, yeah, what is the impact of a bad buying experience? And yeah, you see it in, yeah, reduced win rates, degradation of your brand equity in the eyes of your buyers. Right. I mean, you can still go down the list of things that have real financial impacts.
Yeah, and we've had clients who have worked through this transformation, and it is a mindset thing. It's like, oh, well, this executive doesn't care about our stuff. Our stuff is for technology buyers alone. And once they adopt this and begin to use that muscle and test the messaging and try something new, and it works, just the confidence that they build, that they have, and the excitement that it builds is just, well, it's one of the most rewarding things about what we do, really, is just, you know, hearing those wins and seeing these people grow in their careers.
Well, and that's what Andy, you know, Melanie and I are very positive people. So these are all the sad things, right? Like sellers don't know what to do, and buying executives say 80% believe that sellers don't know. So, I mean, that's all the sad stuff. And that's what Melanie and I, you know, very, very positive people, have a lot of friends in sales. My part of my background is being a former professor of finance. So I still have this, you know, kind of knowledge, mm-hmm. you know, knowledge will set you free thing. And that's why we said, hey, let's do this. Let's stop whining about this. Let's quit reading all these sad statistics. And it's really not that hard. It takes effort. There's no question. But let's do something about it. And that was really the motivation for writing the book. Like, I'm tired of reading all this sad stuff. Let's put something out there that folks can use, practical, mm-hmm. to say, okay, let's turn this around.
Yeah. And it starts at a very basic level, right? And you have a quote from somebody, one of the executives you interview in your book, which really encapsulated is that the quote is, the salesperson should be more interested in learning about my business and stuff, telling me about theirs.
Yeah, it was Dean Myers.
And this is right. And this is something I address in my book as well. This is still the fundamental battle we're fighting in sales, this type of behavior.
Yeah.
Well, that was funny. The Dean, we didn't put this in the quote, but he's a former VP of supply chain, all these very high level positions right. at the Coca-Cola company. And he goes, I want the seller to tell me I got my ass chewed out by my boss because I was watching out for you. And he goes, then I know I got a trusted advisor.
Yeah. So, well, you do have that in the book. I mean, that's
okay.
Yeah. I mean, that's right. But it's, here we are still. You know, 130 years, 140 years almost into the, you know, era of modern sales, quote unquote, modern sales. And yet this is still the most persistent problem we have, is that sellers somehow think that their job is to talk about themselves instead of being interested in the buyer.
Yep.
Nope.
It's like, how do we change this most fundamental things? Because this is something I struggle with all the time. And I get asked about a lot is like, yeah, why? Because this is... as I write about my book, suggesting a change is that, you know, these are not innate human behaviors. These are learned behaviors, right? To talk about yourself before asking somebody about somebody else. So we're wired to be curious and interested in other people. Yeah. Somehow when we put on our sales hat, we stop doing it.
Yeah. And that's how we start off with. I mean, obviously a lot of this is the psychological aspects of it. And that's what Melanie and I wanted to do in the book. What does good look like? I mean, here's what you could aspire to. It's maybe not an easy road to start thinking about how executives think mm-hmm. versus how many countries you sell your product, and here's all the people that have bought it. You know, all these, a lot of things as an executive I could care less about. I just want it to help me achieve goals and strategies and those type of things. But that's why in the book we say, okay, what does good look like? And here's a roadmap for doing that. And, you know, I know we keep saying the same thing, but if you don't have sales leaders and sales enablement in the boat, what I find is about 20% of the sellers out there, you show them this kind of stuff, it's like, got it. Mm-hmm. You never see them again.
Right.
You know, 20% is just not in their DNA. I don't care what you do. It's not going to happen. So it's really that 60% in the middle that you really have got to have that nourishment to help them. But they can do it. We've seen it too many times.
Yeah. I mean, people basically they want tools that will help them succeed. And right. Yeah, I mean, maybe in some cases you're 20% or even part of your 60%. Yeah, maybe this is just the wrong type of selling for them. You know, it's just not a right fit for them. And that's very possible. Right. But yeah, I think people appreciate, yeah, every sort of understands that, yeah, it's just not generally working across the board. It should be able to work for a greater percentage of the people than it appears to today.
Yeah.
Yep. And that's why we start with just the fundamentals of, okay, here's the landscape. Does everyone agree that these are problems? Yes, 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 yes. This is a way to address it, and we make it simple. When we start to talk about financial performance and how executives think about financial performance and how they're measured against financial performance, you get the deer in the headlight saying, oh my goodness, I was a history major, or oh my goodness, I know technology, but I don't know numbers. Well, we break it down throughout the book to provide simple, easy frameworks to step them through to really pull out the complexities. So financial performance, for instance, you know, what does that mean?
Mm-hmm.
You call it different things across industries, but it means three things: growth, profitability, you know, growth, how does money come in the door, profitability, what's their cost structure, mm-hmm. and asset utilization. How are they using the things that's left over to grow, right. to continue to fuel the business? And you see, just when you start like that, and then you peel back the onion to say, well, for a bank, it's called, you know, banks care about efficiency ratio, but mm-hmm. a manufacturer cares about fixed asset utilization. You naturally start to weave in the language and attach it to the financial performance. And it's subtle, but that's an executive kind of conversation, right? It's not, we're installed in 800 countries across the world. I know there aren't 800 countries, but you know what I'm saying.
165, I'm
yeah.
Believe.
Yeah. Our company was founded in a garage.
right.
Yeah. I mean, when we talk about, you know, the three factors you talk about, revenue growth, profitability, and asset utilization, it begs to mind sort of a more basic question for sellers, which is a gap that seems to exist that I see in the way that we educate sellers, is that they just don't have the basic business knowledge. Yeah. You know, how do businesses operate? You know, let alone, you know, let's get into the nuance of how they make money. You know, this particular company makes money or drives revenue growth. Yeah. Sellers just don't come into the sales world educated about business.
No, only the business majors. And we're seeing that there are fewer and fewer. So
well, I'd argue that, you know, even then, unless they've applied it in a real world situation, you still have to reteach
right.
it like everything else in the world. You still have to reteach
right.
it.
Right.
So, yeah. So what's sort of the barrier? Cause you know, you guys come at this from sort of the more financial perspective. What's keeping companies from saying, okay, as part of our onboarding process, maybe our onboarding can't be 6 weeks anymore. Maybe it needs to be 10 weeks. And we need to have a month of just teaching our sellers about business.
Yeah, and you're seeing some of that, but I mean, there's so much pressure on, hey, get out in the field and sell.
Yeah.
And then quite frankly, you know, some of the sales organizations or sales enablement, they don't get it. And then they say, oh, bring someone in to teach finance for non-financial. And I mean, that isn't what you want. What you want is to say, hey, let's talk about how a business works. Oh, here's what marketing does. Here's what manufacturing does. Here's what, you know, HR does. Oh, and by the way, here's how they keep score. It's this thing called gross profit margin.
Right.
Called. So the challenge is most of the financial education I've seen, and I'm throwing another flags at a lot of us professors, is we just start, it's too high. I can't relate to it. I can't imagine a marketing person saying, I'm going to create this campaign and I hope it's got a good response rate because here's how I'm going to drive revenues, or manufacturing saying, gosh, you know, if I could reduce the downtime, I could get more out the door, and that's going to. So the preferred approach to me is start with the basic: what do people do, and then how do they keep score with regards to whether it be financial or let's say operational KPIs like unplanned downtime.
Right.
But the finance piece should almost be last. I tell people all the time, if you, as much as I love finance, I've done it my whole adult life, if you got a limited amount of time, go find out what the client's goals are.
Yes.
Because if you can't align with that and you don't understand who's supporting those goals, align with those goals, you can have all the financial knowledge in the world, and guess what? You're not going to be relevant.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. I phrase it. Yeah, find out what's most important to the buyer and how you can help them get that. You know that, then yeah, everything else follows from that.
Yeah.
If you don't know that, you can have all the knowledge in the world and you'll be off target.
Yep. And it's either not going to get the meeting or it's going to be a very short meeting.
Yeah. Well, I wanted to ask you about something that is in the book, because this just comes up and it's yeah, not unusual. You know, you had a quote from a customer or one of your people you interviewed saying, you know, they demand of sellers, tell me something I don't know in 3 minutes or this meeting is over. And, yeah, my initial reaction to that is, well, how does a seller know what the buyer knows or doesn't know? So what is the best response to that? Because it comes up.
Well, and a couple things. I mean, we heard like Steve Clancy, the CIO at Georgia Pacific, bring me something fresh. You had folks like Dawn Garibaldi from P&G. She said it. Candy Conway, Senior VP of Operations, AT, said. So I asked him, I said, listen, you tell me something I don't know. I mean, you guys have huge staffs. You got all these consulting companies in there. What can a seller tell you that you don't know? And they said, look. We get heads down. People don't think we do. We get heads down. We put the blinders on. They see all these companies in the industry. So, yeah, ask me some questions, but let me know what are maybe some of the potholes or, you know, have you considered this? So their point was share with us the knowledge you've got from all these other companies, nothing confidential. And to your point, Andy, you know, ask. That's what they all said. Like, you know, kind of ask me what are you trying? Have you tried this? Have you thought about this? You know, here's where there's the potholes, the landmines type of thing. So that was a theme that came up over and over and over again.
Yeah. And I write about, I have a series of question types and one of them sort of blends exactly with what you're talking about. I call it an insight question, which mm-hmm. is, yeah, that I think... Unfortunately, sellers are not enabled with enough of these. But yeah, if you get a buyer that basically says something along the lines of what you just said, yeah, tell me something I don't know in 3 minutes. What I coach people and I've trained people on is you have what these insight questions, which is you're asking the buyer a question about something you might reasonably expect they would know about their business, but probably don't. And it's an insight that you glean from the work you've done with other companies, right?
Right.
And it just continues to astonish me that we're not enabling sellers with these types of questions, because this is a guaranteed conversation trigger, right? If you're asking a CEO about something or a high-level executive, something about their business that they probably should know but don't, they're going to want to have a conversation about that.
If you're equipped with how is the customer performing against the industry? How is the customer performing against their peers? Who's doing really well and who's not doing so well? The whole point isn't to poke at them and say, hey, you're really sucking wind here. It's to say, I've spent the time to look at this and I have a curiosity around these topics. It's just so much better than just coming in with the standard discovery questions to try to figure out if mm-hmm. they're going to buy or not, you know?
Yeah. Well, I figured if I can make the customer pause and think with the first question, then we're going to get off on the right foot.
Right.
Because they're thinking in their mind, they're thinking, oh, there's some real insight there. Why don't I know this?
Right.
And how come these guys know this? And, oh, they're probably kind of smart. And as a first impression, that's a good first impression to make.
True.
So, Andy, I was on a call with sales enablement leader. I think it was last week. It doesn't really matter. But anyway, so their revenue growth is dropping, but then they've got they're implementing this new sales methodology that is really more value-based. And so I said to her, I said, wow, you know, I kind of have some insights as to why you're doing that, because I said, I've kind of noticed your revenues are trending downwards relative to your peers. Here's the three things I understand is going to be part of this new sales process. you know, tell me about what you need to do to change. And she was kind of at a loss. She was, we need to start having them think about the customer. Here's three things that we find really gets that jump started. And she just talked and talked and talked and talked. I mean, so for everyone out there, it's not like you have to be a McKinsey consultant and be an industry expert and all these other things. I think it's just basic sales 101. Do your homework, but be curious.
Yeah, it is that simple. I mean, I tell people a story. You know, back in my first sales job eons ago, is selling a room full of computer equipment to the construction industry for accounting purposes. And my first job, I was, you know, calling these CEOs, entrepreneurs that have founded these good-sized construction companies. And you know, I looked 16 and didn't know a thing about business. History major, to Melody's point. And yet I asked sincerely interested questions. And as long as I thought that I was sincerely interested in them and learning about them and what was important to them, they kept answering them.
Right.
And it seemed like pretty soon I was like, oh, well, that's not that it was easy, but like, oh, I get it. Right. Be more interested in them than you are in yourself. And people will spend time with you.
And no matter where you are in your career, right. So that's where it applies to the most senior sellers and newbies, right? Because the fact is, once you understand this and the performance and drivers of performance and how buyers are buying, that is a skill. All these business models can come and go and technologies can come and go. But when you really start to sell in this motion, it's a skill that will last throughout a career. I mean, companies, as long as companies are in business to make money, this is a skill set that's relevant.
And so do you foresee a time when the companies won't be in the business of making
exactly.
money?
Exactly.
Yeah, I just wondered.
Or won't be allowed to make a profit.
Yeah, yeah.
But we won't get into that.
Yeah. So you're right that the executive buyers want three things from sellers. First, you said they want to learn something. We'd covered this. They've learned something that they don't already know. They want you to demonstrate you can help them achieve their desired business outcomes. Absolutely. And third, I think one that doesn't get thought about enough is they want you to make their life easier.
Right.
So,
and that's when we asked, what do you mean by that? And I think it was Ken May, who answered this one. He used to be like the CEO of Top Golf and the CEO for Krispy Kreme. Was at FedEx for a good while. Mm-hmm. And he goes, look, these people come in with these 30-slide presentations. And he said, look, I'm either going to catch up on my sleep or it's going to be a short meeting. And Steve Clancy, the CIO of Georgia Pacific, said the same thing. Don't give me this 30-page deck. I got to go and socialize this with my colleagues. Get it down to one page. Don't make me do your work. So it was just basics. I mean, that's just one example of just, you know, you're still leaving a lot of the work to the executive buyer and they're already pretty busy and they're not going to do your work. So make it easy for them.
Yeah. Well, I think you have a great quote to that in the book. And maybe it was from your Clancy. I can't remember who, but the quote was, if I'm going to allocate my time to a buying decision, I can't afford for it to become a big project. And I thought, wow, yeah, that's such a great quote. And it speaks to a dimension about the whole issue of what buyers want that most sellers don't really grasp, which is they don't want it to become a big thing. You know, they don't want to spend 6 months to make a decision on something they could make a decision on in 2 months if you do a better job as a seller.
Right. And get on with it and get the benefits faster.
And keep it simple, right? We don't need the long wind up. Get right to the point. Time is finite. Jog my interest right out of the gates. We don't need friends. We don't need new golf buddies. We need somebody who's going to help us improve the business. And so further down in the book, or as the seller moves through the sales cycle, it's the same thing as you're formulating a business case. Are there people in the company who care about that detail? Absolutely. But how do you keep it simple and just give the headline so those executives can just get it and ask those questions that they need to? Do not do information overload. Some of the most successful proposals I've ever seen have been one page. It's all you need.
Yeah. Well, I think that, I'd like to summarize what buyer's interest is saying that that's really very simple, is that buyers just want to quickly gather and make sense of the information they need to make an informed decision with the least investment of their time and attention possible.
Right. Exactly.
And if you can do that, perfect, you're golden.
Which is the C, right? The communicate with impact. It's get right to it.
Yeah. I mean, this, yeah, I just, yeah. You know, and you talk to companies about, you know, length of sales cycles and so on is oftentimes you just see so much waste in there. You know, activities that don't help the buyer make progress toward making their decision, that consume their time and attention, and they don't realize that, you know, the impact, the negative impact it's having on the buyer's experience with them, and that they're being penalized for it.
Yep.
So, we talked about the three dimensions you want to link to. The question that sort of came and talked about, you know, revenue growth, profitability, asset utilization, talk about understanding the customers and the customer's business. But one thing I don't see frequently enough, certainly in a lot of the companies I work with, the SaaS world in particular, which used to be much more common, is sellers organized by sort of line of business specialization or vertical market specialization. And that too often sellers are being asked to be, well, they're generalists, but being asked to be specialists in too broad a range of things. I'm interested what you see out there.
We see it shift back and forth. It's like, okay, we need to pull back on travel costs. You have a geography-based territory. So you've got, you know, 10 different customers across 4 different industries. Have at it. And then we'll then see, okay, well, we need to get more specific. So you have vertical alignment this time. So we actually see that shift go back and forth quite a bit. Right. But there's that, the buyers don't change, right? They don't expect you to be an expert unless you're billing yourself as an expert. It's so easy to just get points of view around, okay, what is happening in manufacturing? What is happening in retail? And bring that curiosity along with just understanding the goals and strategies. So you can cast a big net. To me, you know, I personally prefer vertical alignment. That's just me. But every organization has its own way of building things out. And so even still, you want to be able to have that same impact regardless of type of customer, type of industry.
Yeah, and it is challenging when you're asked me to call on banking and then call on manufacturing. Mm-hmm. They've got completely different speak.
Right.
I mean, it's challenging, and that's again going back to sales leaders and sales enablement. Okay, what are the two or three key phrases in those different industries? And I keep saying this, but how do we impact those? So, which a lot of times I just you don't see. In fact, I was talking to an acquaintance of mine a little while ago, but he's in wholesale distribution, and this guy comes in talking about some supply chain solution, whatever it was, but he was using, you know, manufacturing terminology like right, capacity, you know, right, unplanned machine downtime
and unabsorbed and overhead.
Steve is like, what are you talking about? So I mean, we see it going, I mean, I like verticals myself. I think that really allows you to specialize, but if you're not in that space, at least know some of the terminology or provide the sellers with some terminology and in an ideal world, some, you know, maybe some industry expert they can go to, which I see more and more of, but yeah, I mean, just speak my language.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think as a seller, if you're listening to this, is what I would do is, and what I did is I didn't have the mandate to specialize, but I did just because it made more sense, right? Early mm-hmm. in my career, I was like, yeah, wasn't given the construction industry I mentioned before. Is I chose it, A, because there's a great application we were selling that served it, but B is I wanted to become extremely knowledgeable about their business and be able to talk to them knowledgeably and ask the right questions and not be selling to 10 different industries.
Mm-hmm. So you're a vertical guy too then?
I am. And I think it's the smart way to align yourself. I think unfortunately so many companies don't do it because they're afraid that, yeah, they want to do just what you said, Melody. They want to cast a wide net. And yeah, I think that success is more likely to come on the heels of focus than on being broader.
Right.
I mean, there's time to be broad, maybe to understand what niches you should focus on. But once you've identified those, then you should double down and focus on those.
Right. I mean, that used to, it used to, the pendulum would swing based on, it's more expensive to travel, to cover, for a rep to cover a vertical-based territory, right? With the exception, you know, unless you're trying to sell insurance into Hartford or something, unless right. there's a real, but again, who knew what 2020 would bring, and right? what does the new normal look like? So I expect we're going to see more and more and more of that. I'm already seeing clients build more marketing materials around vertical specific. So,
yeah and it, unfortunately, I think for too many companies that 2020 became that spur to do things more intelligently. It's maybe just because I always came up in environments working with startups that we had constraints. We couldn't afford the money to travel like big companies could. So, yeah, even 20 plus years ago, we were selling mostly virtually because we had to, out of necessity. And I think companies need to, as they start getting back into this idea, if they're going to, you know, verticalize, yes, they don't have a geographic territory, is use travel wisely. You should only use travel to advance a deal. You shouldn't be using it on every interaction you have.
That's right.
I mean, if you have to be face-to-face to move a deal forward, then you've got another issue that we need to talk about. Yeah. All right, guys, that was great. So if people want to learn more about Finlistics or your book, what's the best way to do that?
Melody?
Well, you can go to our website, finlistics.com, or you can see us on LinkedIn or Facebook or any of the channels. Mm-hmm. And we also, Amazon, the book's on Amazon. The book's on, the audio book as well is there. Barnes & Noble, any of your book channels, we are there.
Did you guys take turn narrating the book for your audiobook?
Melly and I did the introduction and the conclusion. Okay. And what's really funny, Andy, is I can get up in front of hundreds, if not thousands of people and just talk. Right. I love it. But as soon as that red light goes on, it's like I forget how to talk. So
or read.
We were encouraged to do it, but like, it's too stressful. But yeah, so the book is Insight-Led Selling, Adopt an Executive Mindset, yep. Build Credibility, and Communicate with Impact. And again, it's Andy, it's not just me and Melody saying, here's what you should do, which is self-serving for us. But it's a lot of it's based on working with executives, interviewing executives. And so the other thing I'll add around going to finlistics.com, we have a lot of resources out there. You know, you're not going to show up also when we start twisting your arm. And we do a lot of like webinars. For example, we're doing one next week with a sales enablement specialist who say, look, here's how you can set up a, you know, sales, you know, insight-led selling program. So a lot of good stuff out there. I'm maybe still that professor in me about give, you know, knowledge should be
right.
free.
Right.
I don't know.
Knowledge is free, right. Yeah, you don't run a subscription business, clearly.
Yeah, not me. Melody does.
Right. So, okay. Well, guys, thank you very much. And look forward to talking again.
All right. Thanks, Andy.
Thank you so much, Andy.
Okay, friends, that's it for this episode. First of all, I want to thank you for taking the time to listen. As always, I'm so grateful for your support of the show. And I want to thank my guests, Stephen Timm and Melody Astley, for sharing their insights with us today. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe to this podcast, Sales Enablement with Andy Paul, on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. So thank you for your help with that. And thank you so much for investing your time with me today. Until next time, I'm your host, Andy Paul. Good selling, everyone.
Hey, sales strategists. At Revenue.io, we're not just imagining the future of sales, we're building it. We offer the world's most complete platform for revenue teams, and we're featured in the most recent Forrester Waves for both sales engagement and conversation intelligence. With Revenue.io, you can slash call prep time to seconds, guide your reps in real time to have more successful conversations, and after calls, we generate ready-to-send recap emails so sellers can keep deals soaring toward the finish line at light speed. See the future of sales now at revenue.io.